Okay, we'd like to call this meeting to order. We welcome you out this evening to the Southern Region RAC meeting. My name is Dave Black. I'm the chairman. I'm from St. George, represent the community at large. I'd like to start down here on my far left with Nick, and we'll have the RAC introduce themselves and who they represent.
My name's Nick Jorgensen. I'm out of the St. George area, and I represent the non-consumptive folks.
Rusty Aiken from Cedar City, and I'm at-large.
Craig Love from Iron County, and I represent agriculture.
Dale Bagley from Marysville. I represent an elected official.
Are we on? Kevin Bunnell, I'm the regional supervisor for the division in the southern region.
Lane Torgerson from Richfield, I'm a sportsman's representative.
Gene Boardman from Hinckley, at large.
Mac Morrell, Bicknell Agriculture.
Sean Kelly, Fillmore, representing the Forest Service.
I'd also like to recognize two of the Wildlife Board members that we have in the audience tonight. We have Steve Dalton and Donnie Hunter. We appreciate their attendance and all the time and effort that they put in. The first action item is the review and acceptance of the RAC minutes and agenda, and I'll entertain a motion for that. Okay.
I'll make a motion that we accept the RAC minutes from our last meeting and the agenda for this meeting.
Okay, do we have a second? Okay, from Dale. All those in favor? Looks like that's unanimous. Next item is an informational item, which is a Wildlife Board update. If you recall, at our last RAC meeting, the big item there was the cougar management plan and then also the cougar recommendations. And the cougar management plan passed as presented, with one exception where they added mountain goats into the verbiage, and that was for transplants. Other than that, it was pretty much accepted as presented. The cougar recommendations, if you recall, we had a number of recommendations that went up to the board from the Southern RAC, and all of those were approved with the addition that the Book Cliffs numbers went to 29 permits and the Manti to 13. So they pretty much went along with the recommendations that we had and sent up to the board. I think everything else was approved as presented, and I'll turn the time over now to Kevin for a regional update.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. With our aquatic section, I'm going to let Richard talk about some of the treatments that they're doing here in just a minute. But before he talks about that, just a little update on what's been going on with the quagga mussel issue down at Lake Powell. We had a crew down there this year working the state line and Waweep ramps, and have done a phenomenal job in making sure the boats that are leaving that lake are following the law and protecting the rest of the waters in the state. For example, we were down there the day after Labor Day and talked to that crew, and on Labor Day, that Monday, which is probably the last big boating weekend on Lake Powell, they checked 850 boats in one day leaving Lake Powell. And with a crew of about 8 or 10 people, they were able to process all 850 of them with very few people having to wait for very long, maybe 15 or 20 minutes at the most. So that's turned out to be we had a crew down there that just really gelled and did very well this year. I'll ask Richard to talk about, there's three different treatments that are going or have recently happened or will be happening in the region, and I wanted him to talk about those a little bit.
Yeah, this summer, probably in the last month or so, we've had two treatments that we've completed and got one more on the books coming up here the 1st of October. The first one was in Upper Mammoth Creek on Cedar Mountain. That is part of Cutthroat Restoration Project to reintroduce Bonneville Cutthroat to those upper tributaries of Mammoth Creek. The other two we've got going this summer done. We're both down in Washington County. One was Stratton, or some of you may know it as Grandpa's Pond. That one had some illegal introductions of koi, carp, goldfish, and fathead minnows that we had to get rid of. What was really interesting to me when we did that one, the pond was so full of those koi and those carp that we only found one sport fish. There was one largemouth bass that we found in there when that was done. So they'd pretty much outcompeted everything that was there. The other one we got coming up the 1st of October is Gunlock Reservoir. That one's being treated to remove an illegal introduction of smallmouth bass. With the Virgin River situation and the endangered species down there, we've agreed as the state of Utah to not allow smallmouth bass in the drainage because they are problematic with these native fish. We can have largemouth and bluegill, which is really a better fishery in that lake, but smallmouth bass have shown up in there and are doing very well, so we've got to go down and remove those. So that'll be treated here the 1st of October and then hopefully restocked shortly thereafter if we feel like we did a good job. Just real quick, these illegal introductions really hurt us this summer. We had three of the best lakes on the Boulder Mountain that have had fish illegally introduced into them that'll probably ruin those lakes within the next 3 years and will cause us to have to go back in and do some additional work there. So just one of those things to always keep in the back of your mind. If you see somebody moving fish around, even if you're not sure if it's one of us or not, let us know just in case, you know, so we can get on top of it and try and stop this the best we can. That's all I had.
Any questions for Richard? Go ahead, Dale.
So on Paiute, earlier in the year, you talked about doing a treatment on that again. Is that still in the plans, or is that not?
We did that last year, and no, we did not plan on doing it this year. There was some rumors going around that we might treat that again, but there was no reason for us to do it again this year. They drained it down to almost nothing. As soon as that starts filling again, I got fish ready to go back in there, and hopefully we get water to keep it full for a couple of years. We'll have great fishing if we do.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions for Richard?
Richard, on the Upper Mammoth, have you stocked was it Louder and Castle? Is that the two you did?
We haven't stocked them yet. We just hit those two. We hit one last week, and we'll do one next week, have those two done, and then we'll do them once more early in the summer as soon as runoff is over. We'll treat them one more time to ensure we got the brook trout out, and then we'll have the fish ready to go to put back in there right afterwards. So they will be without fish for a little less than a year.
So next summer, next fall?
Yeah, by fall we'll have fish going back in there. We'll move some adults, but mostly be younger fish, but it'll come back fairly quick.
So rumor is you're going to put tigers in there as well?
We're going to put tigers in Louder Pond, and we may use some in the stream as well until the cutthroat population better established.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. And the only thing I would add is on the treatment there at Grandpa's Pond or Stratton Pond, there's bass and bluegill are going back in there this week, and so that one, it will be fishable again by this time next week, I would guess. Stratton Pond with the bass and bluegill going back in. Moving on to our habitat section, we had two fires in the region over the last month or so. The Oak Grove fire, the one that's been in the news down by in Washington County on the Pine Valley. There was some concern with that one that it would jump over a ridge and be into the drainage that provides the municipal water for St. George. Luckily, that didn't happen. It stayed in a canyon in an area where it probably did some good as far as habitat down there. And our guys are already starting to coordinate with the Forest Service on rehabilitation and making sure that we take advantage of the opportunity to make the habitat better in that area. The other one was the Solitude Fire, which is on the back side of the Pavant, just not far from here. Again, that was a good fire from a wildlife standpoint. It burned slow. It burned through some areas that will really help aspen regenerate and come back, and that one will benefit wildlife as well for in the coming years. The other thing, our habitat guys are just hot and heavy right now in their restoration season. Just in the southern region over the next 3 or 4 months, we'll treat 20-plus thousand acres of pinyon juniper. There's an annual goal of about 10,000, and we'll double that this year. And if any of the RAC members, I've made this offer before, I don't know if anybody's ever taken us up on it, but Gary Besant, our habitat manager, would be more than happy to take any of the, if any of the RAC members are interested in going out and seeing how that's done, whether it's a bull hog, where they're grinding up the trees, or a chaining, he'd love to have to organize a trip to go look at that and talk about the wildlife benefits of some of those treatments. So if any of you have that interest, let me know tonight or shoot me an email, and we can certainly set something up. From our wildlife section, the youth chukar hunt is coming up this Saturday. So if that's an opportunity for just youth to be in the field prior to the general opener. So if you have kids or if you know kids that could benefit from that opportunity, I'd encourage you to get out and take advantage of that. The other opportunity for youth is our pheasant hunts at both the Pavant and the Redmond WMAs. Those will be November 14th. There's limited slots for those. There's an afternoon session or a morning session and an afternoon session at both places. But you need to call the Southern Region office and hold a spot for each person that's or each youth that wants to be involved. Gianni, how many slots do we have left? About half full on both. So there is still opportunities there, but that's an event that we partner with SFW on. I think there's three birds planted for every hunter that goes out. Everybody is successful. It's a good opportunity to get kids excited about hunting. And so if you have anybody that fits that description, I encourage you to get involved. Lastly, here within the next couple of weeks, we'll get a final decision from the Fish and Wildlife Service relative to sage grouse, and that listing that's I think most everybody's heard about. We're anticipating that it will be a not warranted decision, meaning that they'll decide that sage grouse do not or shouldn't be listed under the protections of the Endangered Species Act. We could still be surprised on that, but that's kind of where, if we're reading the tea leaves correctly, where the information seems to be leading us. So you'll see a lot of media surrounding that announcement when it comes out. And it has to be done before September 30th. They're under a court order to do it before then. So it could happen any day now, really. That's really all I have, Dave, unless there's any questions for me. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Richard, for the update. Our next item is an action item. And before we turn the time over to them, I just want to go through the meeting procedures real quick. I'm sure most of you have been to a RAC meeting before, but we'll listen to the presentation. Following the presentation, we'll entertain any questions from the RAC, and then there'll be time for questions from the audience. And at this time, this is where we usually have the confusion, but if you just have questions. And then in order to comment, there's an opportunity to come forward and speak at the mic. And if you have a comment, please fill out a comment card. Give that to one of the officers, and they'll bring that forward. And then you'll have up to 5 minutes to comment on that particular item. So with that, we'll move forward to item number 5, which is the Fishing Guide Handbook and Rule R657-13, and that's Drew Cushing and Paul Birdsey.
Good evening. Mr. Chairman, members of RAC, thank you for allowing me to present this tonight. My name is Paul Birdsey. I'm the Coldwater Sport Fish Coordinator with the Division of Wildlife Resources. I'd like to recognize tonight Richard Hepworth, the Aquatics Manager, and Drew Cushing, who's my warm water counterpart on the Salt Lake staff.
Is that better?
You may remember that up to about 4 years ago, we used to come around in the springtime and do an informational RAC to present what our regulation proposals were and to try and get some feedback from the RAC and from the members of the public. And the fact is that they were not very well attended, and we tried to find another way to talk to people. So we started with this online survey. And this year was no different. We held a survey from May 18th to June 25th, so about 6 weeks. Over 1,800 people responded to the survey, and this was the highest response we've ever had. And the survey provided us with input on the regulation changes that we'll talk about tonight, and also insight to other management approaches. And those other things may be something like we'd like to see a particular species in a particular water, or we want to see a higher limit, a lower limit, whatever. All of those have been passed on to the five regional managers for their review and their recommendations going forward from here. It's interesting to note that 4 years ago when we first did this, we had almost a 50-50 split with people wanting either more regulation or wanting less regulation. And this year when we did it, it was about 70% of the people wanted stricter regulations and about 30% of the people wanted more relaxed regulations. And what we see that is in the hunting world, that would be analogous to the question of quality versus opportunity. And people are wanting, at least our interpretation is that people want these stricter regulations because they want quality fish as opposed to quantity. And we have seen that in survey after survey after survey that we've done over the last almost 10 years now, that there's been this move towards people are willing to take fewer fish home, but they want to make sure that they have the opportunity to catch quality fish rather than just numbers of fish. One of the questions that we asked on the survey this year was about tiger muskie management. As you know, we've had tiger muskie in the state for 10 years or so. And so we are in a position now where we're producing tiger muskie. We've secured that, and we feel like we can move forward with some different ideas with tiger muskie management. So the first question was asked was, do you target tiger muskie when you go fishing? Surprisingly, 41% of the people that responded to the survey said yes, they did. Most of the anglers, 47%, would not harvest a tiger muskie regardless of its size. They're catch and release only. When asked what size a trophy tiger muskie is, the responses were 35% thought that a 40-inch tiger muskie was a trophy, 30% believed that a 45-inch, and 31% believed that a 50-inch tiger muskie was a trophy. So this was a little bit confusing because how do you interpret, you know, a third, a third, a third? But when you combine that with the idea that most of the people that responded only wanted to catch and release a tiger muskie on, anyway, it comes down to that every tiger muskie is a trophy. And so we will be working to try and develop a regulation over the coming 12 months to figure out how to blend these things with people wanting to have catch and release, but still providing an opportunity of them taking home a trophy if that's what they choose to do. So we also asked a question regarding our kokanee salmon regulations. We have We have created a couple of new kokanee salmon fisheries over the last few years, including Fish Lake in this region. And we've used two different strains of kokanee to do this. We have an early spawning strain, and then we have a late spawning strain. And that late spawning strain is also called the lake spawning strain. And we wanted to be able to have a regulation that was standard across waters that would protect both the early and the late spawns, but still provide some opportunity for people to catch them. So we asked them, would you support a closure to possession of kokanee from September 10th through November 30th? And this is a regulation that's been at Flaming Gorge for a number of years, and where they have both strains of kokanee. And 87% of the respondents supported this recommendation. Okay. So, and corn has been a topic of discussion as a bait for as long as I've worked for the division, which is quite a while. And so we wanted to know how popular would corn be if we offered it as a legal bait. And only 38% of the respondents said that they would use corn as a bait if it were allowed. Now, one of the things we didn't do was filter that by those people that said that they fish primarily with bait. So we're going to be going back and asking the question again next year, saying, if you fish with bait, would you fish with corn, to see whether those percentages change or not. So anglers have requested over the last several years that the DWR develop a sportfish slam program similar to the waterfowl slam or the upland slam. And that is, you catch fish of different species throughout the course of a year, and you'll get some kind of acknowledgement for that. So we asked the question, would you participate in a slam if it were available? And which groups of fish would be the most popular slams? Number one was the native cutthroat trout slam. Number two was the bass slam. And number three was the pike slam. So we will be moving forward probably over the next month or so, putting together the native cutthroat trout slam to roll out in 2016. And then if it's successful, we'll move forward with the other ones in time. So, from that survey, then we've developed the following regulation changes. We'll propose to have a standard reservoir kokanee closure as follows. Close to the possession of kokanee salmon from September 10th through November 30th. This would also affect the tributaries of places such as Electric Lake, which currently has a close to possession of red kokanee salmon. So that would come out of the books, and it would just go with this one. And there's a couple other waters that have that. There are other waters, such as Strawberry Reservoir, which have a separate tributary closure. They will remain in effect. So, but this would be in effect for the reservoir itself. In the central region, their proposals are to have a couple of new community waters, Pole Canyon Pond, Bartholomew Pond, Deer Valley Lakes. For our standard regulation for a community water, it's two fish of any species. We propose that regulation for these three waters. We also have had a long-standing problem at Strawberry Reservoir in defining that area known as the steps or the ladders. And because the current definition is dependent on water level, we'd like to just standardize that, remove any ambiguity there, and define the ladders as follows. And the Central Utah Project Canal, commonly known as the steps or ladders, from the fenced-in upper concrete structure upstream to the tunnel at US 40, we close the fishing. Northeast region, we currently have a catch-and-kill regulation on Walleye and Red Fleet Reservoir because of an illegal introduction. We will be treating Red Fleet to remove those fish next week. So in 2016, we want to just reinstate the statewide regulations at that reservoir. Southern Region, Fish Lake, Sevier County. Currently, is the regulation reads four trout, only one of which may be over 24 inches. Because we did introduce kokanee this year, we'd like to say, change that to say four trout or kokanee, regardless of species, only one of which may be over 24 inches. Manning Meadow Reservoir is our brood lake for Bonneville cutthroat trout in this region. They have a good population of Bonneville cutthroat trout in there. We feel like we can allow some harvest of those fish now. So we want to change this to a two trout limit, regardless of species, artificial flies and lures only. And it would be closed from January 1st through the second Saturday in July, as is currently. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the RAC? Gene?
On this, where you close it to an area for kokanee, can the average fisherman, or the less than average fisherman, the bait guys that just go to catch, can they tell a kokanee when they catch one?
Kokanee are pretty easy to tell, especially at that time of the year. If they're mature kokanee, they are turning red, or in the case of the late-running fish, they get almost black. The other ones are pretty distinctive from your standard rainbow, and they're not... They're kind of a special fish. They don't typically respond to bait. So if you're going to catch a kokanee, it's pretty much because you're fishing for kokanee.
Okay, do we have any questions from the audience? Okay, come forward. This mic over here, and please state your name, please.
My question is, Mr. Birdsey, on the internet surveys, do you send out a random invitation or just announce that in the newspaper and people answer to it?
I need to come to the mic to respond.
Yeah.
This particular survey is a non-scientific survey in that we simply allow people to respond to a link on the web page. However, we have many standard statistically valid surveys which correspond closely with the information that we receive through this non-scientific survey.
Brad, can we get you to state your name just so we have it on the minutes?
Okay. Brad Bradley from Anti. I was just curious because on the internet surveys, I don't have a lot of faith in them. I'm going to crank the clock back as an example to about 2000 when there was a lot of wilderness advocation in the state. And SUA and environmental communities started putting up internet surveys and listing them as these are scientific surveys of what people want. And the off-roaders, it didn't take very long for them to build up a network. So that every time that SUA listed, do you want wilderness, the emails went out across the network and SUA's survey came out with 500,000 people against wilderness and 2,000 of their members for wilderness. So it didn't take long to build up a network to route that survey the direction you want it to go. So I just have a hard time with internet surveys. My personal experience with people in the field and interviewing them, when I ask them a question, what is your opinion of what should be changed? Or tell me, actually I ask them, tell me about fishing. Tell me why you fish or why you don't fish. And the number one complaint among all those, and I should, when I say number one, I would say like 50% of people that I talk to, And I did this for 35 years to relay information back to other supervisors. The number one complaint that came up was too damn many regulations. So I'm kind of having a hard time with the internet results. If it was Rocky Mountain Anglers, that they all of a sudden contacted all their guys and said, quick, respond to this survey because we want to change the regulations on this pond. We want more regulation. That's just my comment on internet surveys.
Okay. Thank you, Paul.
Brad.
Or Brad. Any other questions? Okay. We have two comment cards. Was this your comment then, Brad? Did you have anything else?
It was for later.
Okay. So this is the time for comments. So if you want to come up, please come up and do that. And then,
so this is the entire fisheries presentation for tonight.
Okay. First off, I really want to congratulate Mr. Hepworth and what they did up at Fish Lake last winter. I don't know that it made a dramatic change in the perch population, but it's probably the neatest thing I've seen done since Gene Snow in 1985 on Yuba, when he showed up with his little 20-foot van from Angler's Inn and was selling jigs and fishing lures and everything else, and turned a perch into a game fish overnight. Went from nobody on the ice to within 2 weeks you had thousands of people on the ice. So I think anything that promotes fishing like that, I don't know if you have it planned this year, I hope you do it 2 or 3 weekends. I'll give you something to do. The next thing I'd like to suggest is, you know that I appeared here a couple years ago and advocated the 8-fish limit. Just a straight 8-fish limit, not the 4 and 4-fish limit that we have now. I can see that the boards aren't willing to go to that straight 8-fish limit. We're stuck with the 4 and 4. However, along with the regulation thing, I would really like to see the DWR app. That's another one I got to congratulate you on. I think that's one of the neatest things since canned milk. To be able to pull up that app. And I hope that your officers back there also recognize that when you show that on the app I have my fishing license, is that acceptable? Along with that, I'd like to see that app expanded. If you are going to go to more regulations, it would be really cool if on that app, any water that you're going to in the state, you could search that by county, or water and county, because you have to have that because some waters, you know, have the same name in 2 different counties. But if you could search that and hit that water and know what the regulations are for that water, that'd be a great thing to have in that app. The other thing I would like to see expanded in that app is the ability to notify for emergency openings and closures. Another great job that Mr. Hepworth did this year was at Paiute, when the water was dropping, to open that up and increase the limit on it. I had to find out about it through the grapevine. I didn't see it in the news, but I'm sure it was there. But anyway, it would have been really neat if that app would have had an alarm that popped up and said, hey, there's a change in the regulation. That could be used either for emergency closures or emergency openings, but any regulation change that's brought up in the middle of the season. And if you did that, I would suggest one more thing. And that is, we have a lot of high mountain lakes that end up winter killing and the fish don't carry over. They're put and take fisheries. I've got a half a dozen of them in my area that I frequent regularly. By the end of the season, September 15th or so, it'd be really cool if that app would pop up and say, you know what, all those fish are going to die. So in Shingle Mill and WPA and Deep Lake, the limit's now lifted from now until January 1st. And people could harvest those fish out at the end of the season before they winter kill. All I have to say, thank you.
Thank you, Brad. Good comments. We have a comment card from Bryce. Did you want to come up? Okay, he just wants to indicate his support from SFW on the DWR's recommendations.
Bryce's last name, please.
Pilling.
What's this one?
One more? The next one.
Okay. That's all the comment cards I have. Do you have any comments from the RAC? Okay. We just want to summarize in the comments. Mainly, it looks like from Brad was to expand the app to include, these are good comments. I don't know that these would necessarily be, would they be part of the regulation, or would they be suggestions that would go?
They, some of them may have implications for the guidebook, yeah.
So we could include those in a motion if you so desire. So those were to expand the app to include regulations by water and county. Also that it would indicate emergency openings and closure alerts, and include emergency regulations to remove limits on lakes with winter kill.
So. Mr. Chairman, if I might respond, there was a meeting last week at the division office for some of those things, such as the tying the regulations to the water, to the app. That is currently in development right now through our e-products and services. Those other things that have not been included that I'm aware of, but I'm assuming that the committee would be open to incorporating them in the future. But as far as that one goes, it already is in development.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. Okay. I'm ready to entertain a motion. Okay.
So, do we have any closures on or limits lifted on lakes that are going to winter kill now? I mean, is that something that happens now, or is that something that needs to be addressed?
Richard, do you want to comment on that? If you think that would be relevant to the southern region, or if Drew or Paul want to comment on that?
I can address it really quick for the southern region. This was brought up last year at the RAC with the lakes mainly up here on Cove Mountain, which is Deep Lake, and some of those. Right now, we do not have any seasonal increases in limits based on winter kill, but we have been discussing it, and I would guess that next year it'll be part of our survey. At least for the southern region, we're going to approach it at some lakes. Does that help?
Yeah.
No, we don't right now, but yes, we're looking into it for possibly down the road.
Is that something you would be in favor of, Dale? Where are you coming from?
Well, I'm just trying to decide if we need to even include it in the motion. So I was wondering if we have anything in place right now, or if that needs to be included.
Never
so
hurts to include.
We, and just speaking from a statewide perspective, no, we have not addressed it through a change in the regulation. But as a former manager in the southeast region, the way that I addressed it on the few lakes that I knew that had a high likelihood of winter kill was that I would schedule the stockings to be of a size and timing that most of those fish would be removed through the course of normal fishing pressure, and I have to guess that Richard and the other managers do that. The biggest problem with having kind of a across the board, it's going to have a doubling of the limit or no limit or whatever on an annual basis, is that we may wind up with a winter like last year, where it's entirely possible that we did not experience a winter kill in all but, in none but maybe just a few of those waters. So while we're very cognizant of the idea that fish that are stocked cost money and that they're there for the fishermen, we also want to make sure that we are not eliminating opportunity based on, maybe even the 5 out of 7 year norm or whatever. So we do try and take it into account, but I don't know how to address it moving forward in terms of just having a standard regulation.
So you still can leave it in your motion if you'd like.
I'll make a motion to support Rule 657-13 as proposed, and also look at putting emergency, I guess, limit suspensions on lakes and reservoirs that have a high likelihood of winter kill.
Okay.
Look into that rather than make a regulation change right now. Is that what you're suggesting, Jeff?
Yeah, to look into to that, changing that.
Okay, do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a second by Rusty. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Unanimous? Thank you. Do we have, is there a second part to the presentation, or is that?
That's it.
That's the item? Okay.
You guys are all wanting more, but that's it.
Well, it has two people and cold and warm, and I'm just checking. Next item is informational, and it's the hunting technologies discussion, and Rick Olson will be presenting that.
Okay, good evening. This is going to be pretty short. You'll be back in Bicknell in plenty of time tonight. Okay, this is informational only. Go ahead. The purpose of this presentation is to look at some of the other Western states' regulations, to review some of the technological advances that have occurred lately, and most importantly, to present the survey results of a pretty impressive survey that we put out there. Again, it's informational. There will be no vote tonight. The purpose of this is really we need to know what the RAC feels about these issues. We know what 19,000 people think, hunting folks. We need some discussion, direction on where the RACs would like us to go with some of these issues. These issues are social issues. They're not biological. And one piece of advice for the context of the discussion tonight, try to separate social from ethical, because there is a difference. If you ask the Humane Society of the United States, all hunting is unethical. If you ask a guy that's dyed-in-the-wool flintlock muzzleloader, inline muzzleloaders are unethical. A longbow hunter is going to say a compound bow is unethical. So we're really not talking about ethics. We're talking about what does the hunting society think about these issues. Okay, this year we sent out a survey to 77,000 2014 general deer and elk permit holders that were at least 18 years or older. This was an invitation online by invitation only, so if you didn't get an invitation, you didn't get a chance to participate in the survey. The survey was open from the 27th of July to the 16th of August. They had three possible answers to each question, a yes, a no, or a no opinion. As you'll see in a minute, people have an opinion on this. 19,000 responses. This is the highest response rate the division has ever had on any survey that they've ever put out there. So people are interested in this, and they have an opinion on it. Okay. This is a breakdown of the respondents. One of the questions was asked, what weapon type do you hunt big game with most often? 47% of the respondents normally use a rifle, 22 muzzleloader, 31 archery. Now, when we first got into this survey, we thought that we would have to present the results based on weapon type, meaning that archery hunters are going to feel one way, rifle hunters will feel a different way, and muzzleloaders will have their opinion. As it turned out, there was less than 2% difference between all of them. So it doesn't matter whether we break it out by weapon type. So I'm going to present the results tonight all together, because if you look at each individual weapon type, it doesn't change at all. Okay, the first issue that we looked at was allow use of a draw lock. Okay, just to go back a little bit. One thing that we found it's really hard to do is to compare different states with Utah. You're not always comparing apples to apples. A lot of it is because different states have different hunt structures than we have. For example, some states will have a muzzleloader hunt that you can only use a open weather ignition type weapon, and then another season when you can use any kind of muzzleloader. So it's really hard to compare apples to apples when you look at some of these issues. Draw lock, it comes into play here. Of the 16 states we looked at, three allow a draw lock on an archery season. 10 do not, 3 are silent. Now, in some states, if they're silent, that means you can't use them. In some states, if they're silent, it means you can use them. It's all in how their regulations are developed. In Utah, you cannot use a draw lock on an archery hunt unless you have a COR for that. Now, you can use a draw lock during any legal weapon hunt. We ask our hunters what they thought. Should a hunter be allowed to use a draw lock on a bow during the archery season? 69% said no. Okay, the next issue we looked at was magnifying scopes on bows. 7 states don't allow it. 8 states are silent, so we don't know whether they allow it or not. In Utah, we do not allow a scope on a bow currently. So we ask our hunters, what do you think? 70% of our hunters said they do not want magnifying scopes on a bow during an archery hunt. Okay, we ask our hunters, should range finders that are attached to a bow be allowed during an archery hunt? And on this one, 60% said yes, they do want that. They do want a rangefinder on a bow, but they don't want a scope. Now, I think that we get asked this question quite a bit when you're in the field. How come I can go like this and look for a rangefinder, but not this? And you never really had a very good answer for them. But at least right now, our hunting public want the ability to put a rangefinder on a bow. Okay, crossbows. This was a hot topic last year. There actually was a bill run by a legislator to allow crossbows on the archery hunt. In the end, that legislator withdrew that bill, but the division made a commitment to him that we would take this issue through the public process and see what the RACs, public RACs, and the Wildlife Board thought about this issue. So if you look at this map, the states in green allow a crossbow during an archery season. The states in blue do not. Again, in Utah, we do not unless you have a COR, but you can use a crossbow during the any legal weapon season. We ask our hunters, what did they want? 60% said they did not want crossbows allowed during a deer hunt, archery deer hunt. They also don't want them allowed on the archery elk hunt. Same percentage, 60. And 56%, the vast majority still, do not want crossbows allowed on an archery hunt, on a limited entry archery hunt for either deer, elk, or pronghorn. Okay, we ask one other question. If crossbows were to be allowed during an archery hunt, should a magnifying scope be allowed on those? 69% said no. Now, this does create a little bit of a problem because the vast majority, if we were to ever allow crossbows, the vast majority of the manufacturers all make a bow that has a scope attached to the bow, and it's almost built into the bow. It's very difficult to remove it. You can't just undo a couple screws and take it off. Okay. Other than crossbows, the next biggest question we get from the public every year is allowing magnifying scopes on muzzleloaders. Again, the states in the green allow it during a muzzleloader season. States in the blue do not. Again, you can use a scope, a magnifying scope on a muzzleloader in Utah if you want to hunt during any legal weapon season, but not on a muzzleloader season. So we ask our hunters, what do you want? 57% said they do want to be able to put a magnifying scope on their muzzleloader. Now, this could have something to do with, you know, why I need these to read now. Our hunting public's getting a little older. They want the ability to see better. Personally, the way the regulation's written right now with a one-power scope, when I look through a one-power scope, the target looks smaller than if with just open sights. I've had some. I don't know how credible they are. Doctors tell me that you need at least a two-power scope to be equal with what your eye sees normal. But regardless, our hunters want the ability to put a magnifying scope on a muzzleloader. Okay, on rifles, we looked at a minimum caliber. Seven states have no minimum calibers at all. Four states require 22 or larger. Five states, 24 or larger. In Utah, we made it simpler. It just has to be a center fire with an expanding bullet. We did not ask our public what they thought about a minimum caliber because we never get a question from the public. What's the smallest gun I can use? Our hunters want to use a weapon that will be efficient. Okay, we did look at maximum calibers because we get asked this question a lot. Currently, only two states regulate maximum caliber. North Dakota has a maximum caliber of 49, so they're outlawing those 50 cals that are more popular now. Idaho attempts to do this by limiting the weight of the gun. You cannot use a gun that's heavier than 16 pounds. Now, I'm not sure why they did that. I personally struggle with this one because I don't want to have to buy scales for these guys and they have to go out there and like, let me weigh your gun. But the reason Idaho did that was to outlaw larger calibers. Okay, we ask our hunters, should a hunter be allowed to use a very large caliber rifle, 50 cal or bigger? 71% said no. They should not be allowed to do that. Okay. We looked at rifle-mounted range-finding scopes. Hunters do want to use them. I'm not sure how many different manufacturers. The only one I'm aware of is the Burris Eliminator. But it's a range-finding scope. It does not cast a visible beam of light out there. But it is a rangefinder built in with the scope. Those are currently legal in Utah, and our hunters want them to remain legal. Okay, new technology. Smart guns. Do you guys know what a smart gun is? okay? This is a really cool weapon. I hate to even call it a firearm, but it's a weapon. It's a computer-aided precision guiding system on a rifle. If you go to the internet and Google trackingpoint.com, be prepared to be wowed. This is a gun that at some point you have to at least put the crosshairs or the dot on your target. And then you push a little button. It's called tagging it. After that, you pull the trigger, put your finger on the trigger, and you just have to get close, and the gun will fire on its own when it's ready, when the windage, everything is calculated by the computer, and it will hit that target every time. They even have goggles now where you can be pointing the gun like this, looking like this, and you can see the target in the goggles, and then it will just fire. So you don't even have to look at it. I've hunted with a few guys that could really benefit from this, but anyway, we ask our, currently no Western states outlaw this. And Utah's one of them. You could use one of these if you wanted to currently in Utah. We ask our hunters what they thought. Okay, 84% want these type of weapons outlawed. You never get 84% on a survey. You can never get 84% of people to agree to anything. So it's pretty telling what the hunting public thinks of these things. Okay, so in summary, when you looked at this survey, our hunters do not support the use of crossbows during an archery hunt. They do support putting a rangefinder on a bow and a magnifying scope on a muzzleloader. They do not support large calibers, and they don't support the use of a smart gun. Now, there are a lot of other issues out there. We did not ask about round ball versus sabot, electronic primed ignition systems. We realized real quick, if we want to look at these types of things, we need to bite it off in chunks or it becomes too big. When you get into the survey world, if you ask somebody to take a survey that's 20 to 30 questions, people won't take it. They look at it, it takes too long to do that. They will answer 10 to 12 questions, as we've seen here. Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there any questions from the rack?
Yes. Well, it seems to me your survey people are concerned about maybe wounding animals, so they're the range finders for bows and a little better quality optics for the muzzleloader, so maybe there's some concern there with the wounding.
I think we can't really, sometimes it's hard to interpret what people think. I think on the scope issue, people just want to be able to see better, and they think that that will increase the likelihood of making a good shot. Now, the downside to that is if you can put a 9-power scope on a muzzleloader, will that cause you to take a 800-yard shot because you can see it?
Do I have any questions from the audience? Okay. Okay, we're going to turn it over to comments here in just a second. So do we have a comment card on that?
Just Bryce, and he didn't want to come up, just that he supports the survey results.
Okay, so the Bryce appealing SFW supports the survey results and wanted to extend that support. That's the only comment card from the audience, so we'll turn the time over for comments from the rack.
Dave, I know we have a couple of gentlemen that came just for this item. Did you guys want to make a comment?
Just mainly information what we're getting.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure.
Okay, Craig?
I was one of the ones that took this survey. I got the survey and took it. I thought it was really good. But in fact, the only thing I disagreed with it on, the results on, is I think I'm not in favor of the muzzleloader scopes because these modern-day muzzleloaders, you put a 9-power scope on, you might as well send them rifle hunting. So it takes the, you know, takes the sport out of a muzzleloader. So that was my only comment. Well, and the other question I guess I had, will we see this later on in coming in as regulations? Or
yeah, we'll come back in the November RAC and board process with some sort of proposal. Now, we don't know what this proposal is going to look like yet, and that's why we need you guys to comment on this to help us. What do you guys want? We know what the public wants.
And that's my only comment. I agreed with every one of these except that one. So
okay.
Okay. Gene?
On this large caliber, I don't see how you're going to police it. If you say 50 caliber, somebody's going to neck down a Browning machine gun to a 49 caliber. If you say 49, they'll neck it down to 48. According to your survey, people don't want that, but you're going to have hunters that are going to work at long-range guns no matter what you do. They'll always try to improve the technology within the limits that they can. And so I don't see how you're going to be able to make a regulation that's going to slow down this. Well, you can slow it down, but I don't think you're going to defeat this long-range.
Yeah, I'm not sure. There's a lot of other calibers that are a lot smaller than 50. You gun guys, I can't think of them right now, that'll shoot a long, long way. But for some reason, the public just doesn't want a bullet right now that you carry one bullet in your hand.
Okay. I guess as far as my comments go, I did receive just a couple of emails, and my wife took the survey as well. And the comments on the emails pretty much mirror the results of the survey as far as the majority vote on that. So they go right in line with the survey that I've seen.
I have the opportunity to do the survey too, and my comments pretty much agree with your summary. I'm one of the blind guys that would like a magnifying scope on a muzzleloader, but I can see the drawback, the negative aspects to it also.
All right, you guys. Rick's looking for your opinions. So those of you that haven't shared it, I'm going to ask you to share it. So, Sean, what are your thoughts?
Well, I didn't take the survey, but my own personal thoughts kind of fall along the line with that. And the fact you did the survey, I'm impressed with, and you got such a response, kind of tells you you're right. You do have some pretty serious people that are thinking about it. That's. I guess I agree with what other people are saying on it.
Yeah, just one comment on that. We actually had a lot of people call up our office, our biometrician that handles these surveys, and they were upset. I want to take that survey. And she said, sorry, you didn't get picked. And they almost wanted to talk to the governor. How do I get a chance to take this survey?
I think I support what survey results are. I don't have any problem with that.
And just from the sportsmen that I've talked to, you know, at the coffee shop talk and of course, with the hunting season upon us, and we sat around the campfire and talked about some of this stuff just the other night, and there's a resounding support for magnifying scopes on muzzleloader, just, I mean, that's kind of across the board. And I think a lot of the guys that I talk to or that I hang around with are pretty adamant. A lot of them are adamant muzzleloader hunters. And part of their response was that they feel like they could take a lot less chance of wounding an animal with if they were able to see it better and make an ethical shot. And shot placement would be better if they could use a magnifying scope.
I took the survey as well. I'm a little bit hesitant on the muzzleloader optics. Maybe can you limit it to a 4 power? Would that keep them from taking a 300 shot?
Yeah, we could limit it to anything we want, I guess.
But, do they make those small scopes with this 4?
It does make it harder for us to enforce if we made it 4 power or whatever. We would
it's
find
no difference
guys,
than a 0 power.
We'd find guys with 3x9s, but honest, I only leave it on 4.
No.
I kind of agree with what Craig had to say. My understanding is initially muzzleloading was kind of a primitive sport and that it was supposed to be an extra challenge. I'm not going to disagree with what the public wants, but my opinion would be that we ought to leave it that way. Thank you.
They go from everywhere, but really, this is my third rack I've presented this to, and your comments are right in line with all the other racks.
That I might add is I'm not sure how you regulate the long distance guns, but that was the guys I talked to. Every one of them was opposed to having hunters out there shooting over 1,000 yards and with the long distance guns. And they think there's a place for that, but not out hunting. So.
Yeah, well, while you're around your campfire, now everybody's got a tablet like Brad's on right now. Just Google tracking point and look at that stuff.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Our next action item is from Kevin Bunnell, and it's the draft 2016 rack and board meeting dates.
Okay, gentlemen. This is your chance to influence. Now, what's on that? We can't adjust dates. Okay, the dates are set. Or when the Wildlife Board votes on this, they will be set. But right now we have 3 of the meetings that start earlier than 7 o'clock, the April meeting, the November meeting, and the December meeting. And we can go to different places. So that's we can leave the schedule just the way it is. I'm fine with that as well, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to hear your thoughts on maybe different venues for different meetings, and also if you think any of the other meetings need to start at different times than what we have them right now. So what are everybody's thoughts? Are we happy with the way it is, or are there some changes you'd like to see made?
Go ahead, Craig.
I just might make one suggestion. The November one, you know, this tends to be a long one, and not late in the year, we'd go to 5 instead of 6.
So Craig's suggestion is to make the November meeting also a 5 o'clock start time instead of a 6 o'clock start time. Anybody have any heartburn with that?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay, Lane supports that as well. Okay, and Dale, seems like there's general consensus that might probably be a good idea. Yeah, that's a long meeting. The December meeting,
Does it need to be at 6 o'clock? I know the bear stuff's gotten less controversial lately. Would you like to keep it where it's at? It's also during the winter, so it's dark a lot earlier, and maybe 6 o'clock makes more sense just from a travel standpoint that way. Okay, everybody's okay with that. What about locations?
It's going to be a little less confusing to the public if you don't have too many different start times. Just with that in mind, I would encourage you to go with 2 start times instead of 3 if you can. December meeting.
Okay, so the December meeting, let's make it either 7 o'clock or 5 o'clock. I think that's a good suggestion from Lynn. What's the preference there? You want to go an hour earlier or an hour later?
Yeah, late. I'd soon go earlier.
Go 5 o'clock?
Yeah.
Okay, so that would give us 3 meetings at 5 o'clock, the April, the November, and the December. That sounds good. What about locations? Are we happy with locations? We've been coming here to Richfield at least once or twice a year. This is a good venue. We have a couple in Beaver, and we went to St. George for the first time last year. We hadn't been there for quite a while. And traditionally, we've done at least one in Cedar City. Does that seem to be a good mix for everybody? Mm-hmm. I see a lot of heads nodding that we're okay with the locations. All right, so we have this down as an action item. Somebody make a motion for me to. I think the only changes that we're talking about is the November and December meetings to be 5 o'clock start times instead of 6 o'clock start times.
You'll make that motion. We change those 2 times, and other than that, adopt the agenda for the meetings next year we got.
Okay. Second on that? I'm doing your job here, Dave. Sorry. But I'll let you call for the vote.
Okay, any discussion? We got a comment from Rusty.
That's a really tough time to, right in the middle of December, a lot of kid programs, it's really hard to make those. So maybe in the future try to do that either into January or later in November.
I think you've got 2 board members here. They have the freedom to move things a little bit, and so they've heard that comment when you guys address this at the board meeting. You know, maybe take that into consideration.
I just have one comment. The dates that are set here, I know that we've tried to, the last couple of years, Kevin, we've tried to have it so the southern region was not always the first meeting in the series of RAC meetings. Is that addressed in here?
So for years we were the first. This was the first year where we're now the third, and this proposal keeps us third. The way the rotation's going, and I think that puts us in a better position. This schedule sets up the way this year. You'll have the northern region and the central region 1 week, and then you'll have the southern, southeastern, and northeastern the following week. So we're third of 5, right in the middle.
Mac, I don't want to pick on you, but it seemed like you've had some comments on times and stuff in the past. Are you okay with this schedule?
He's talking to you, Mac.
You're good? Okay, thanks. I just want to make sure. Now's the time to address it. The only other thing that I'd suggest is, like tonight, on this particular meeting, I think this is a great opportunity to have the informational presentation that we had. Otherwise, it's a fairly light agenda historically. And so if we could encourage some type of presentation next year at this time, I think that's a great time for us to be educated and kind of fills the meeting up a little better.
Dave, I got a question. What about having an update on what's happening on Monroe Mountain, on studies going on there for next year or something?
At this September meeting?
yours. Yeah.
I think that's great. I was just going to ask and solicit ideas because I think Dave's comment is right. This is normally one of our shorter meetings. There's a lot of work going on Monroe Mountain. I'd be glad to arrange to have the guys from BYU come down and kind of give a summary of their results. Why don't we just plan on that for this meeting next year? Okay, good suggestion, Mac. Are there any other particular issues that you guys would like to know more about that we could fit in as informational items, even if they're just coming to the southern region? I know I'm catching you cold with that, but if you do have those things, zip me an email, and I'll try to accommodate those things and get you the information you're looking for.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor? That's unanimous. Motion carries. I have no further business tonight. Does anybody else have anything they'd like to bring up? Okay, we'll call this meeting adjourned.